football purist like myself, it's just it's boring. It's a boring style of football, you know what I mean? I'd love to see a Loria team go out there and sling it around the park against some of these guys, see how they handle that. I don't know. It's a style thing for me, but you know, my bias is clear, I'm sure.
Hello and welcome to At the 55, your home for OUA football. Me and Tom are back on the mics to bring you episode 3 of the Exit Meeting series, where this week we are back in the T.O. breaking down the U of T Blues. Tom, I gotta throw the how the heck you're doing quick, because I'm just so excited to introduce our guest today. Tom, how the heck are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great because our special guest is here. Our guy is back.
U of T former... A U of T season ticket holder, former possibly spring camp offensive coordinator type guru, but of course you know him as the pivot that finished his career at Queens second all time in passing yards and with the third most prolific single season of passing yards accumulated. You might not know the face because of course he played OUA football, so if you're tuning on YouTube, you now get to know how Nate Hobbs looks. Nate Hobbs, welcome back to At the 55. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing great, you know, it's a little rusty behind the mic again, but you know, just want to say how much I've enjoyed being a consumer of this great content during my hiatus. So,
well, much like I said to Dakota when he joined us to talk about York football, hoping that mic and that seat feels just as warm as we promised we'd keep it for you. It's always fun having the three of us back in action. I think the question that I'll start off with, obviously, we're talking about U of T football here. Read off just a few of the accolades, and we could have gone much further. No one knows your accolades as well as you do, so perhaps they'll just come out naturally in the course of this conversation. But people might be wondering, why is Nate Hobbs here on the U of T pod, not the Queens pod? Mentioned you did a little coaching stint with them. You are a season ticket holder. What's the deal?
Yeah, well, I think it goes back to a little known fact also is my brother actually played for U of T, my older brother, so... Before I was even, you know, applying my trade at Queens University, I was frequently watching some U of T football on Saturdays in the fall, albeit hungover from some high school night outs, but always found my way to the games and, you know, had a break from that when I was at Queens. But being in the city and living down the block, you know, fan of OUA football, you can't go wrong on a nice Saturday afternoon going out and watching some games.
Best place, arguably in the whole province to catch a game. But of course, me and Tom were pretty live and direct for a game in your old house, or I guess the revamped version of your old house. Let's jump into this season with what the U of T Blues did, because this has been an interesting stretch of games for them, going back to when you know you were on the pod with me and Tom when we were seeing signs of life coming off the Clay Sakara years. Then you know we get this kind of revamped offense with them going, the quarterback looking like it's going to be a promising spot for them, and just things aren't picking up right. You know, from your perspective with how you've been watching this team, what do you think is kind of the direction they're in right now, kind of just generally speaking, big picture viewpoint on it all?
Well, it is a bit of a transition period, and I think you go back to their playoff season a year prior, and you know that was a bit of a surprise to some people. Some people had picked them to go 0-8 that season. I don't know who would have done that.
Seems silly
in hindsight. But I think what's kind of missing from the whole conversation is, you know, they lost a few of those star receivers. They lost Clay Sakara, but what remained was some seasoned veterans on the O-line. And, you know, because of a COVID situation, you had guys that were, you know, entering their mid-20s, still playing OUA football. You had a bunch of wily vets on that line that had played together for years. And I think, you know, last year, they really suffered losing a few of those guys. And, you know, U of T hasn't exactly been a hotbed for O-line recruits over the years. And I think that's really borne itself out. And I think that's why they struggled. I mean, you look back to that season prior, and it's like obviously Kinsale came on strong, but what really drove them was the ability to run the ball and run the ball fairly consistently out of big personnel. And they just, you know, weren't able to have as much success of that. So I think that's sort of the biggest area for me and where they are right now is trying to figure out that line spot, because you go to their games and there's no doubt, you know, whether it's Kinsale or Barnett, two talented guys at the pivot, you know, you got talented guys out there, wide receiver making plays, but it's just lacking a bit of consistency on the front right now, I think.
Yeah, and I think it was pretty apparent really early on, especially in that first Guelph game, that they didn't have the same force that they had up front. And even to a certain extent, it's funny enough that every single year, if there is somebody who comes out and he's really surprising everybody, like Kinsale was last year, despite the fact that it's a week-by-week thing, I still feel like it's almost like he takes the league by storm for that entire year. This year coming into it, it kind of felt like the entire league knew what who Kinsale was, knew the dangerous capabilities that he had, whether it was throwing, whether it was running. Did you see a drastic change in the style of play that he had or his effectiveness because of that offensive line? Or do you think that he just didn't have those veteran receivers like you were talking about to really throw to or even bail him out of certain situations?
I think when you watch the games, there just didn't seem as comfortable. Didn't seem, you know, as decisive, let's say. And, you know, maybe that's, you know, probably has a lot to do with the O-line, kind of second guessing where it's at. But, you know, that's speculation. If I think back, you know, it wasn't I can't really say like how much better, how much worse Kinsale was. I think it was a bit of a raw deal for him, honestly, you know, to kind of how things went for him and going with Barnett. But, you know, still a super talented kid and someone who I would like to see play at this level a bit more while he has time. So,
well, on the point of time, I'm pulling it up right now. I mean, Kinsale, I think it's showing that he's fifth year in school, third year eligibility. And I think Tom and I were kind of talking at a certain point, whereas with Barnett, it's 2-2. And obviously Kinsale being from out of province and to whatever extent that plays in, like, it's like, I feel like we talk about this on the pro level of sports when it comes to, you know, you think about like, oh, you know, build around the guy on the rookie deal and everything like that. But there is something to be said about the fact that if you only have so many years with these guys to begin with, you're a former quarterback, you know, and who is as proficient as anyone at a time when maybe your team wasn't quite at that level. I mean, what do you think of the idea that maybe you make a move to a guy where, even if we say in a vacuum, Kinsale's got more tools, he's proven it at this level going back to that year before. The O-line piece, I think, explains a lot of the dip we saw from Adam Williams running the ball this year and all things. But do you think there's anything to the effect of, hey, maybe we're halfway through the season, it's not going how we want, let's go to the guy that we know we have a few more years around? Or, like, I don't know if we see that often in the OE way. Or what's your take on that?
No, we don't. And I think, you know, it's a bit of an old dog's mentality that you kind of let the vet ride it out, you know, even if it's the end for him and it's his fifth year and the team's not going to the playoffs. Usually I think there's just has been that level of respect there over the years. And, you know, sometimes maybe it's not even the right decision, but that's typically just how it's gone. And, you know, I think it'll be really interesting now when you have a different coaching staff in there. You know, I don't know who the coordinator is going to be there, but it's going to be a fresh start for both those guys. Obviously, they both have put tape out there, good tape. They both have good tape. They both made their fair share of mistakes. So I think what it'll come down to is, you know, obviously there's going to be a new system, but it's, you know, it's a lot easier to kind of go in there and start the young guy and kind of buy yourself a little time there. Kind of you, especially when you're coming in, it's a fresh start, you know. You know, as a coaching staff and as the program, you're going to grow. So you kind of want someone who's going to be able to grow with you instead of, you know, you invest all this time in a guy who's maybe only got 1 year, unless they really think they could win this year, which, you know, I'm not entirely sure they do. I can't say for sure. I hope that's not the case, but it's definitely a transition time. And, you know, as a coach, you might think you're better off investing with someone who's going to grow with you.
Hmm. Well, before we continue on this path here, the real question, the hot burning question that everybody wants to know, if Coach Adams comes calling Nate Hobbs, are you taking that coordinator position or what?
You know, I can't say anything. You know, I don't want the good folks at FanDuel blinging my line and asking me what's going on. But, you know, I love coaching football. That's all I'll say. And
my phone. We're not ruling it out of the cards then. All right. So if somebody was a new offensive coordinator, for example, especially a guy like Darnell Adams, who's seen the prolific ability of a Trey Ford type. I'm not exactly saying that Kinsale is like Trey Ford exactly, but they certainly have a lot of similarities. I think the arm is there. I think the capability to run certainly is there as well. Does that influence anything going into this? I guess time will tell, and obviously that coordinator coming in. But he gets benched, and Scott Barnett comes in. To his credit, I think Scott actually played pretty well based on the fact that he's kind of thrown into the fire there. What were your initial thoughts when you first saw him take the field instead of Kinsale?
Yeah, I mean, he's a talented kid. He's someone who's got all the tools, you know, is a bit inexperienced with show at times, but he also showed he can make great plays. I mean, what sticks out to me most is, you know, his time. I think it was his first year when he came in late in the Western game and drove it down the field a couple times for him. And, you know, the potential's there, right? And I think the challenge now for both those guys is learning a new system, right? And it's not even just a new system, but when you have a new quarterback coach, even the way you might read defenses and your way your progressions work might be different, right? Like, you know, for example, I had, you know, Coach Powell's my coordinator 3 out of 5 years. And then my last year, we switched to Marcel Belfe. And that last year, the way we read defenses completely changed. You know, it wasn't a, you know, low half to second defender. It was just inside out or outside in or high low. It was just way simplified. So when you think about it that way, like, things can either get simpler for these guys or more complicated. So I think it'll be really important for whoever comes in to kind of nail that, because it's going to be crucial to kind of how they're able to succeed early on.
Well, you know, you mentioned, you know, Barnett's outing against Western. I think me and Tom both had comments when they were playing Western this year too, that, you know, you put the final score away, because that's often just not all that productive when you talk about how a lot of teams end up when they play Western. But a lot of good things on that game. It was a night game, kind of ironically back-to-back night games that we've seen with Western and U of T, going back to the year prior when Western came to visit Toronto at Varsity Stadium. But, you know, putting that one aside from just, like we said, some of the good things we see out of them, you know, they take Waterloo close in that final game of the season, a game where, if memory serves, I think they might have still been within contention of getting in that 3-5 spot. Yeah, I think that was like a win and you're in with Waterloo. And on the one hand, it's just nice to see that they stepped up to the challenge. That loss against Ottawa that we were all in attendance for, you didn't want to come sit with us, whatever. That's a discussion for off mic, I suppose. They're obviously really in that game. And then even that Queens game where your alma mater's coming in there. And once again, don't look at the final score. That was a game where first half, you know, especially with Queens, you know, losing that game to Laurier, they get the bye week, and then they have Western the week after. It had just that feeling of they're looking way past this game. Like, Toronto's in that one. I say a lot in saying that the 2-6 season, not obviously anything to write home about. And I feel like in many ways, U of T, I don't have that big a read on from this year because they were hard to read. But when you look at a lot of these games, like I said, they're the difference of 5 or 6 points away from sneaking into the playoffs. And then some really good outings, all things considered, against some of the top teams. We talk about these things of like, are they rebuilding? Who's in that quarterback? New head coach? But generally speaking, like, is this team, do you think, in a shape where all pieces, like, considered, they can be, like, making a run into that seventh seed, especially now there is an extra playoff spot? Or is this really, a true rebuild?
I mean, it's possible, but this also feels like the position that U of T has been in for the past 10 or so years. When you go back, they've always been, you know, aside from a couple years early on in Greg Marshall's tenure, it seems like they've been the proverbial, you know, 2-6, 3-5, one went away, one game they maybe should have had. But the reality is they never had it. And then all of a sudden, that MAC game that got them in the playoffs a year ago, they had it, right? And so I think that's really going to be the key. And I know Coach Greg Marshall sort of, even when he was my DC at Queens, had a way of kind of hanging around in the game with his defenses. And, you know, that definitely helped U of T a lot, and sort of the way they manage games. You know, definitely did not play like these NFL coaches you see today all the time. But, you know, he picked his spots to go for it, and they cashed that season. They went to the playoffs. So I think it's a team that's going to be on the borderline for sure. And the reality is can they win that Ottawa game, for example, in the past year? There's going to be a game like that this year that's either going to put them, you know, to 2-1, or it's 1-2, or, you know, it's you go down to 500 and then you play Western the next week and your season's over when you should have had it, right? So that's the thing about OUA football too in general, is it's 8 games, and if you mess one of the ones up that you maybe could have should have had, you know, the opportunities dry up quick when you know, the Westerns and the Queens ruling the town, right? So if it's close, you really got to make your money at that point in time. So I think, you know, for this team, that's what it'll come down to.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about the resiliency of a team like this and what Coach Marshall brings into this, it's obviously going to be a big change. Now, Coach Adams, obviously experienced as all heck, coming from Waterloo, coming into a new system here. But even in your time there, and I don't know how much you really had in the recruiting side of things when you were there as well, but Toronto, this U of T team, is probably one of the hardest places to recruit for in general because of the academic standard that's there, and that university is not willing to bend or break on that whatsoever. When you were there in that room, what did that look like, and what do you think is Coach Adams going getting into taking on a team like this at such a prestigious school?
Yeah, I don't have a ton of insight when I was in the room, honestly, but I think there was a clear shift, especially when you look at sort of before when I was in school to after we finished, because U of T in the past was a place where you had a lot of guys who they'd sneak into UTM, for example, and they'd be taking the shuttle downtown to practice or lifts. And because of that, you know, they might be late, or, and, you know, when you talk to alumni from the program, which I see some from time to time, I happen to live with one, so a couple actually. And the reality is it's really hard to build a culture like that. It's really hard to enforce any kind of standard where, you know, you have people that essentially are held to a different standard, and there's a reason for that different standard. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's going to be incredibly hard to build a cohesion when you have half the team living, you know, what's only 20-minute drive away, but with traffic up to 2 hours trying to get downtown. So I think during Greg Marshall's time, they really kind of shifted more towards guys who could get into school. You see a lot of guys coming from, you know, these football programs out in BC, these strong places that are football guys. You know, they're less project guys. They're guys that they know that can play football. They've played a few years of football and they understand what it is. So I think what's going to be really interesting when you see Darrell Adams come in is he's going to kind of have to link up with, you know, the staff that's already there and kind of decide who they're going to be, because I think they have had a good amount of success with this different strategy that they've brought in over the past few years, and it's yielded results. So, you know, I think if there was a way to marry those two and, you know, grab a couple of these athletes closer to home on top of some of the football guys I'm getting, I think, you know, that could be really dangerous. But, you know, obviously everyone's got to get into school, and that's not easy. So at the end of the day, you got to prioritize those guys that you know are going to be 4 or 5 year guys, because if they're not, then you're wasting your time, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, and the idea of like grabbing the guys like around the city or just kind of the GTA extended, obviously that's a major talking point. Like when we were talking to Dakota about York football, it's a major point. I know we've just talked about your Mississauga guy, you know, so much talk about whether it's Brampton, Etobicoke in the city, like that this area does produce some of the best talent. And that's a conversation that, in terms of why these schools haven't been able to perhaps hold on to that talent, kind of manifest for different reasons. But bringing York into the conversation, once again, kind of touching on the experience you had in that locker room, where you mentioning that, you know, living with a couple of alum there and just your connection with your brother and all things into this program. From the U of T perspective, you know, and we talk about that record always being like a win or two away from making playoffs. I mean, it helps when you know you're going to get York on your schedule because of the rivalry, right? But from the U of T perspective, like, does it mean, like, how much does that York game matter, especially where I mean, not that U of T's been a world beater in recent years. You had some those Bird Gang years, Clay Sequeira. You know, there were some explosive years, but like recently, it's just been that York has really hit such a low in terms of what they've been pumping out there. As far as the component of Toronto football at that level, which you know is near and dear to my heart, what is that like from inside a Varsity Stadium and just like the training grounds there when guys are, you know, prepping for York Week, Red Blue Bowl, Argo Cup, Battle Toronto?
You know, I think obviously it's a heated rivalry, and I think probably at times both teams can kind of almost be a bit dismissive of each other just because, you know, they both think the other sucks, but they know this is sort of this heated rivalry. And, you know, the way it kind of shakes out is sometimes that at least this is way back, not so much the case recently, but there are times where that's, you know, that's sort of the only meaningful game left in their seasons. So, you know, it can be pretty competitive, right? And I think at the end of the day, there's sort of a rivalry there. I think there is a bit of a, you know, Toronto being seen as kind of, I guess, you know, the pretty boys of of the rivalry, kind of being in the city with their high academics, you know, and their old buildings and whatnot. But, you know, it's definitely intense. And, you know, I can say it's, you know, I would say even like the chippiness is definitely more than a Queens Western, even if that's when I was playing, right? I mean, there's more back and forth in that rivalry than Queens Western, unfortunately. But
yeah, and so we've talked a lot about the offense, obviously, here. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about that U of T defense, because despite the fact, you know, obviously, like we said, I think a lot of the issues with the offense came from that senior offensive line starting to graduate, this defense still had a lot of real gamers here. Ryan Stewart really blew my socks off looking at this guy. I mean, even just looking at some of his stats, he finishes with 57 total tackles. The next closest to him on the U of T team is 27. Five and a half tackles for loss, one forced fumble, two interceptions, five pass breakups. Like, the guy was all over the field for them, and I think was obviously a standout on a U of T defense that actually did a pretty good job really setting up the offense. Now, obviously, when you look at like the takeaways, that's a lot.
Might be
because of my my alma mater and their own struggles there, but that was really the U of T like eye opening game this year. Whereas last year, I felt that was Carleton. How did this defense really, in your eyes, aid in this team? And do you think that they, you know, how did they attribute to how this year really went?
Yeah, I think, like you said, it kind of came things close. And like, they were always a team that would capitalize off the odd turnover and did well off the turnovers. So, you know, any football team that's going to do that is going to be good. But like I said, just the way Coach Marshall played defense, it was something that it was a lot of, you know, bending and not breaking would pay off in a lot of situations. And what happens at OUA football is like, if you hang around for a bit and, you know, team doesn't score over 30 points, then it's a good chance you could be in the game, right? So for me, it was a group that, you know, hung around, was feisty with the turnover games, and you know, really was able to keep them close in a lot of games. And sometimes, you know, the dam broke, and the Western game, for example, at the end of that first half, right? So it didn't always go their way, but definitely a chippy group, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, what Coach Adams brings as someone, you know, who might be a little more pressure oriented than Coach Marshall was. So it'll be interesting to see how their identity develops and if it shifts at all here.
I got to take a minor pause from the U of T specific content, because obviously we've had many conversations on this podcast, the three of us, you and me, Nate, about all things OUA, and we're coming off of just a flipping awesome OUA season where we see Laurier as a legit contender trying to take out Western. Western obviously just doing what Western does and then falling short in the semifinal and somewhat ugly fashion, your alma mater having a strange season where their defense and run game are arguably unstoppable, but Vreakin's a little banged up, and obviously you're familiar with him, having seen him come up the ranks as kind of that next up, the local product. Windsor continuing their ascension with that defense and that three-headed running game with that, you know, huge offensive line. The Ottawa team's playing some incredible ball. Corey Grant and year two at Carleton with that air raid offense with All-Canadian Kasim Ferdinand catching balls there for Tristan Lefebvre, and even Waterloo and Guelph as teams, or kind of in different lanes, but Waterloo showing a lot of feist, and Guelph, you know, the Ryan Sheehan piece now, but a lot of nice things with Tristan Abboud, a young quarterback. So as Nate makes a face when I mention Ryan Sheehan's name, so, you know, so I'm just throwing every possible and
my guy.
I'm speak on it. I'm throwing like every possible OUA take outside of UFT. Yeah,
you can't be everyone's guy. I'm not everyone's guy.
We're going back to when we did our stock game a couple years ago. You're buying low on Coach Sheehan right now in hopes that he'll have a rise back
Coach
in Calgary.
Coach Sheehan's got another head crane up in Calgary, buddy.
Well, you know what? When you go where they are, you know, it's easy to claim them, I guess. But, you know, a million takes we can talk about from this OUA season. I threw a half million at you just there. What was, you know, aside from the UFT side of things, what was some of your favorite highlights from this season?
Oh, man. It was good to see sort of, you know, selfishly the rebirth of kind of the elite quarterback in the OUA, the real game changer. The guy was really going to sling it around the park in Taylor Elgersma. I feel like, you know, I don't know if you recall some of the conversations we had about how the game was changing in the OUA. You see in the NFL too, you know what I mean? With sort of this emphasis on the run game and whatnot. But to me, watching Elgersma was like a real throwback, honestly, to sort of the days of yesteryear with, you know, the faults and the Brannigans and things like that. Just a guy who's going to will his team sort of to the finish line. And for me, that was sort of my highlight, was seeing some of that back in the game again.
Mm-hmm. And even staying on that same vein, because it is something that I wanted to get to as well, in your opinion here, I think the state of quarterback across the league right now is in one of the best spots it's been in recent memory here. You've got guys like Evan Hillock, Taylor Elgersma, Tristan Lefebvre, Tristan Abboud, and all of these, the list goes on and on, obviously Alex Vreakin and whatever else. In your opinion here, do you think that this is just like a cyclical thing, like quarterbacks are just coming and going here, or do you think the standard of what a quarterback is in the Canadian game, even from a younger area, or like the high school level below, is starting to come up and starting to match that same level of excellence that we're expecting from these OUA quarterbacks?
Yeah, you know, I'm not like huge in the world of sort of, you know, player development in like high school and things like that. You know, obviously did my fair share of quarterback camps back in the day, but I think what's happening is you're seeing something kind of mirroring the states a little bit in sort of the attention, the detail that quarterbacks are getting from a young age and the amount of training that they're getting. And I think, you know, you look at all the stuff that's so accessible now and guys are just way more polished coming into school. I think that, to me, that's the biggest difference is, you know, I can look back at my film or whoever's film and yeah, it could sling the ball, but like the mechanics still pretty raw. Whereas today, you know, a guy like Tristan Abboud can come in and, you know, it looks like he's been playing for 3 years already. Right. So for me, that's the big thing is guys' feet and how they move, how they throw the ball. It's just way more polished now from when they get in there. So a lot less work for these coaches to do on these talents. And it's really kind of a testament to how there's been more attention there in terms of player development coming up.
I want to point out super quick, Tom did not mention the name Keegan Hall in his listing of great quarterbacks around the OUA. Taking this...
God, anything to just drive the Mac thing down my throat,
We invoked Cam West and talking about Sheehan going out there. We're talking about all the great ball in the OUA. I can't remember exactly just quite how thoroughly your finger is on the pulse of kind of the youth sports level of even just conversationally, because we obviously have talked about, and Tom, you know, I forget players' names all the time, but lists off so many of the great players. Such a great time right now for OUA football when you just look at how these teams are producing and kind of this, you know, and as you mentioned, this kind of renaissance of great quarterback play in the OUA. And maybe it's because we've had a few years of falling short of that highest mountain of winning Vanier's, where it feels like some of the conversation in the ex-Twitter sphere of things is that there's still this OUA bias. And obviously, you know, you look at a guy like Rooker and you look at, you know, a Heck Creighton coming out of RSEQ, and obviously all the things that we've liked out of Silas out east, and with, you know, your Huskies, you'll have to give us a little, you know, bark at some point here, Nate Hobbs, just for the fans out there. Such great quarterback play, such great football being played across Canada. OUA none less than any other, to the extent that you still have that sense of like how these other conferences are doing. Do you still feel like, or maybe I'm putting words in your mouth by even saying it like that, but like, I feel like me and Tom have always felt that OUA Ontario football still is a cut above when we look at across the board. You might say top talent's a little different, but where do you kind of rank our province right now against some of the other contenders out there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's deep. I think it's deep. I mean, you look like at a team like Windsor, who's, you know, the fourth team in the conference, and it's like, you know, you compare that to the fourth team in Can West. Obviously, much smaller pool, but you know, I think they do pretty well in that scenario. And I think, you know, this might be a bit of a take, but it's just like that Western team that we send out there every year. I mean, I just don't know if like they're built to face like a team of equal caliber. You know what I mean? I mean, you look back to the teams that won the Vanier, and, you know, it was sort of a bit more dynamic, you know what I mean, with Chris Merchant back there, and sort of, I want to say, like, it was just a bit better. It was a bit different in terms of how they played football, and sort of, you know, they lacked that element with the running quarterback that they've had, you know. Hillock's a great player, but it seems like they're not able to go blow for blow with these teams. And I mean, that was borne out in the Montreal game, a lot of turnovers, obviously. But when you go out and you play a team like Montreal, or you play the team out west, like, your size advantage is not the same as playing against Carleton or whoever, you know what I mean? Like, so, you know, obviously I don't love Western, but I think at the end of the day, it's like, it is disappointing to see, like, not that I've ever made it even close to going out there, but it's like disappointing to see, like, the team that goes out there, it's like we get rolled like that against Montreal. It's like, you know,
it looks bad on all of us, right?
Yeah. It's like, this is the team that's bullying us, and, like, you know what I mean? They got nothing for them, right? So let's not say it's all relative, you know what I mean? If you could tell me I was trash, you know, relative to wrestling, and yeah, I mean, that was true. I didn't win any playoff games, but I think at the end of the day, it's just, you know, it's football purists like myself, it's just it's boring. It's a boring style of football, you know what I mean? I'd love to see a Laurier team go out there and sling it around the park against some of these guys, see how they handle that. I don't know. It's a style thing for me, but, you know, my bias is clear, I'm sure.
Well, listen, first and foremost, let's set the record straight here. You might have been on some Queens teams that had some difficulties, but the number two passer in one of the most prolific football teams in all of Canada here, that's nothing to sneeze at, Mr. Nate Hobbs.
Yeah, you only saw it because you went to a Queens game. You wouldn't, if you didn't go, you wouldn't have known that. So,
not just a Queens game. We were in the Pavilion, brother. It was pretty swanky. Yeah,
I haven't even been in the Pavilion, man.
Yeah, you got to be number
your name's
one.
Up there,
you
got to
be number
You're
one
etched
on the
in
list.
Stone.
Danny Brangan's getting invited.
So I haven't given any money back.
Switching gears to get back into U of T here. We kind of danced around the topic and kind of mentioned it a little bit, but I want to put you on the spot here. If you're coming into this room and you've seen the things that Kinsale has done, and you've seen the things that Scott Barnett has done, taking in mind where they are in their careers and how much they have. And like you said, even though Kinsale struggled this past year, I think he's got a world still left to give, and he's got the talent that's there. Where are you leaning in this regard here between a Kinsale versus a Scott Barnett? Is it purely based off of what style of offense is it? Or are you, no matter what, going outright with either one of these guys?
You know, I do have personal bias for Kinsale because I did coach him back in the day. And, you know, I know he's a good kid. I know he, you know, works real hard. But I think it depends on like a lot of the extra personnel as well, right? Like the offense you're going to run with Kinsale is probably a lot different than the one you're going to run with Scott Barnett, you know? So it depends, you know, what I think I'm going to get out of my O-line. You know what I mean? Am I going to really benefit from a guy who's going to scramble around? Am I going to need that? You know what I mean? If the O-line's holding up or not, right? Like A, having that ability to escape in the pocket, but B, being able to add that dimension in the run game and be able to play more with numbers as opposed to, you know, sort of bashing my head against the wall. You know, I could be more creative there. You know, the way that I like to to coach a little bit, I think that would be useful, but it's also difficult to put that in, put on all the reads in and get all the different formations in. So it's difficult. You know, I actually would feel good going either way, but my personal bias is going to be considered just because I've seen him firsthand. You know, the Barnett kid, he looks good on the field to me, but you know, as a player and as a person, you know, that's not the role of my guy. You know what I mean? There's bias there, but that's how I feel. So how about you? What do you think?
I think it comes back to the style of offense, like you said here, but I think you have more opportunities and more options with Kinsale than you do with Scott Barnett. I think Scott did a very good job, obviously, when he was in there, and he finishes with 8 touchdowns, 8 interceptions, and was put in some scenarios. And anytime, no matter what, if you just throw a quarterback in halfway through the season or even a couple of games into the season, that they're not in training camp getting all of the first team reps, I'm sure. Even if they're splitting time, they're still splitting that all of the reps they could be getting. So there's something to be said for that for sure. But when you look at the explosive capabilities that Kinsale has and the arm and the fact that he's been in this offense, I still think that he's the guy that you go to here. And even being that wily vet now going into his fourth year of eligibility, he's seen more stuff. I still think that he's the best pick, but it really depends on, well, how is that offense going to change going into this year?
Yeah. And I think, you know, maybe it's just my lack of confidence in myself as a coordinator, but never hurts to have a guy who can bail you out either, right?
Well, but that's interesting because, like, we've had this conversation before going back to the turnstile rotating door, whatever you want to call it, of your boy Ryan Sheehan's offense at Guelph with, you know, two, sometimes three quarterbacks. And you being the literal quarterback in the room amongst us, I believe we're the advocate for saying that, like, that confidence, knowing that, like, your guy knows week in, week out, has that ability to calm your mind. You can just worry about the next play, form that connection. And, like, the earlier you can make that, the better. And me and Tom already talked about this a couple pods ago, thinking about with the Ottawa GGs, where they're in a similar situation where they now have three guys that have shown a pretty solid proof of concept playing at the OUA level with Ben Maracle, Ryan Lacanjo, and now all of a sudden our guy Josh Jansen slinging it out. And like, the sooner you can solve that, the better. But kind of going back to something we talked about earlier, as far as like what is U of T's potential, does that equation change if it's like the difference of, well, hey, if we're, you know, Ottawa has a chance to, you know, like obviously make playoffs and contend for a home field playoff game in the first round this year, not knowing all the different things that are going to change. U of T's not quite on that level. So maybe on the one hand you say, well, sure, they can play around with it a little bit more. They can figure out who's going to be the guy. But at the same time, if you're going to admit that like you have that time to play around with one quarterback or the other because you don't think you have that upper echelon, you know, shooting for a high ranking playoff spot or not, then once again, why not just go to the young guy? But I guess, as you said, that's not really how OUA functions. I don't know, like a couple things thrown at you there, but keep the call.
No, I think if you look at it, yeah, if you're looking at it objectively, no matter who it is, you have to decide early, because what gets missed a lot is sort of the investment that comes early in terms of reps and practice. You know, those of us that have played know it's not always a 50-50 split, right? Or at least, you know, it shouldn't be. If you're the quarterback, and you know, that extra time makes a huge difference. But yeah, I mean, if you're coming in this like a fresh start, you don't owe either of these guys anything. They're not your guys. You didn't tell them to move their whole lives to the city. You know what I mean? Sort of the hand you've been dealt. So I think at the end of the day, if I was being completely objective and, you know, I saw you know, Kinsale, you know where he's at, you know, he can give you. But if you see that, you know, you think Scott Barnett can be like a top three guy in the OUA one day, then maybe you'll ride out some misfires in a season and, you know, be willing to take that, because, you know, in the long run, when you get more of your guys in recruiting and you feel more comfortable with where your team's at, he'll be coming into stride at the same time. So, you know, if you being completely objective, that sounds pretty good to me. But luckily not my deal to figure that out. So
now taking a look into some of the potential talent that these guys might be missing here. Once again, we've detailed this on other pods, but with the COVID year, some guys are up in the air. Some guys still have, even though they're listed as fourth or fifth year, they might still have some eligibility. But as it stands right now, between fourth and fifth year players, they have a total of 13 seniors. I'm going to run through this list here, and I want you to tell me, where do you think the biggest potential loss would be if all of these guys left? Okay. David Osho, fifth-year wide receiver. Kinsale Phillip, third-year eligibility, fifth-year of school. Nigel LeGood, fourth-year wide receiver. Adam Williams, fifth-year running back. Nick Green, fifth-year receiver. Dawson Elliott, fourth-year DB. Quinn Mulligan, fifth-year fullback. Matthew Huang, fourth-year linebacker. Jeremy Sinclair, fourth-year linebacker. King Huang, fourth-year linebacker. Garrison Pyle, fifth-year offensive lineman. Keenan Dell, fourth-year defensive lineman, and Jackson Mayer, fifth-year defensive lineman. Who on that list stands out to you as a potential loss to this U of T team?
Oof. I mean, Nigel Good's my guy. May have aided his development back in the day, but I'm going to throw a curveball. I'm going to say Garrison Pyle, because you know, he's sort of one of the last vestiges of that senior O-line group and, you know, was there when I was there. So that tells you how long he's been around the program. you know, I just think having a guy like that on the line is important. You know, honestly, don't really know what his impact is on the field last year, but I think having a leader in that group and sort of where they're at right now, and someone who's going to be able to herd the cats to some extent, makes such a big difference on the line more than anywhere else on the field. You know, there are guys that could come in at receiver and you can have the quarterback hold them in check. But I think on the line, you really need that veteran presence there to drive the group forward.
Yeah. And obviously a couple other names, like, you know, Tom mentioning Mayer's name in the mix too, like on the just defensive line as well. Obviously we don't need to talk, like, stress how important just winning the trenches are. So just maintaining that integrity from the standpoint, as you raised, as having that veteran in the mix is obviously so important to setting the tone for the next generation. Last question I have, Nate, and maybe more of a comment. I'm hearkening back to having the inimitable Jack Moore, legendary broadcaster, former member of the Laurier Golden Hawks, 2016 champion, telling something to the effect of, or slinging some mud, I believe, as he called it. I might have to phone a friend on Tom on this to recall the full details of the story, but slinging some mud your way, Nate, hearkening back to a story going back to, I think, some Mississauga Warriors, Oshawa Hawkeyes days, or maybe it was a high school game. I'm trying to remember, Tom. Maybe I need to help you. Maybe I need to call a friend on this one here, but let's go on the way back machine here. If you know, you have any words to send back the way of Jack Moore, because we're going to have him on a pod in the not too distant future ourselves. I'm just trying to keep this probably non-existent rivalry, or at least the one that's only existing in my head, burning. Any thoughts to some story that Jack might have relayed about a battle you two had? I believe it probably was at the former Sky Dome back in the high school days.
He's not an Ottawa guy, is he?
No, Pickering area. Maybe it was a Dolphins. Okay, that's what it was.
It was a summer league game, I think, based off of, if I remember correctly, it might have been like a U16 type of game, championship. Oh. And our guy, Nate Hobbs, goes off and snatches victory out of the jaws of defeat. I think that's what Mr. Moore is dredging.
Oh, you mean the undefeated season we had in JV, where the only game that I finished because we were blowing everyone out was the championship game. The game in which we were down 21-0 and then came back to win and, snatched the championship out of their hands. Oh, that one.
Oh, yeah.
I barely remember that one.
Oh, that's excellent.
God. But fantastic. Yeah, just the very last comment from me. When you look at the state of the league here, just in general, and we've already talked about how difficult it is watching our OUA representative get out there and not perform nearly as good as we are expecting to. And maybe it's even getting to a point now where those teams are starting to expect, okay, when we get out of our own conference, we're playing against Western and they typically run a game like this. But when you look at the rest of the OUA and you look at the top to bottom talent that we have in this province, and even with bringing guys in from different spots, from when you played versus what you see now, do you think that the OUA has taken a step back, gone forward, or remained the same in terms of the quality of talent that's on the field?
I think there are definitely more good teams now, and I think the parity is a lot better. That is the one thing I would say is you go down through the bottom of sort of where the playoff teams are this year, and sort of anyone could have anybody. And while that was true for a handful of teams back in my day or our day, I think now this year in particular, I mean, not necessarily true the past few years, but it felt like having a Windsor and a Laurier step up. And where those two Ottawa teams were at, it felt like there's a good amount of parity there, for sure. I don't know. That's how I feel about it. Do you guys feel differently? I don't know. It was your era a bit more golden? I don't know.
No,
Yeah, go ahead, Tom. Sorry.
yeah, I was just gonna say, and I think I do tend to agree with you. Getting back into the days, into my day, it was Mac, it was Guelph, it was Western, with Queens kind of on in that realm of just being there and just being down. But it was really those teams at the top, and certainly you had that parity in the middle. But I think it was a little bit more like you had those top teams and then kind of everybody else. Whereas here, you did have Western, who was at a high level, obviously going undefeated once again this year. But there's a reason why Zach and I picked Laurier twice in a row, thinking that they were going to come up and win
The
here. And
answer is
there's a reason
CTE.
why they did. We think that there was so much parity here. And I love the direction of this league and how good all of these teams seem to be getting, even if you're a 2-6 MAC team. You're still a couple of plays here and there from being a 5-3 team, or at least a 4-4 team, which I think is a great thing for the OUA.
Absolutely.
I'll.
I have another question. I have
Oh,
more questions.
yeah.
Yeah.
Ooh.
That's okay.
The rust is knocked off. He's back. He's back at it. Let's go.
That's back in form.
Okay. So if you could pick who's going to be the next team to win the Yates Cup that is not Western?
Zach, you take this one.
The bet's got to be Laurier. Could have had him twice this year and not just because of head injuries like that. As you highlighted, Elgersma's that guy. Does he have more than 1 year left in the OUA? When you look at the size, the arm talent, the athleticism, all those intangible things too, and does that close their window? Maybe. Windsor obviously hanging their hat on a defense and a running game with Joey Zorn being kind of the head of that. How sustainable is that? And it's we kind of talked about this when we were talking about Mac last week or earlier this week or whenever the hell it happened, where with so few teams, like it's not building a program the way that you do in the pros, where you can, aside from having to manage, say, salaries and things like that, you can just like go sign a player, you draft a player. It's like windows close, open and close so quickly, aside of if unless you're Western. I mean, in some regards, it has to be Laurier, and other than that, I don't think we've really seen that contender just because Windsor, I don't know how sustainable that is until we can see who that quarterback's going to be that runs it for them. So I think the answer has to be Laurier.
Yeah.
I
I think
feel.
the dangerous pick, like I think what's dangerous about Windsor is sort of what they're doing in recruiting is unlike what everyone else is doing, and that's because they have to, but you've seen the results that it's bore out in like a couple of years, but if that continues. I think at some point, you know, it's just it's proven to be such a different advantage. And you know, they're getting guys that other teams just, you know, aren't seeing or don't have the capability of getting or aren't looking for. But yeah, I think that to me, that's kind of a scary one. That's not my pick, but I think that's a good shout there. As you know, obviously, it's easy to say, oh, if they get a Taylor's algorithm, they're going to be really good. But even someone close, you know what I mean? But sorry to cut you off. Go ahead, Tom.
No. Just for I do strongly feel about Laurier, and I do fully believe in Taylor Elgersma, certainly. But honestly, completely healthy without all the variables in play
He's gonna
here,
say Guelph.
I'm leaning towards Queens.
Ah, dang it.
I'm Alex Vrekin, that's got a few years under his belt now that feels a little bit more comfortable, albeit obviously coming back from an injury here. That defense that, while maybe losing some guys, having a guy like Silas Hubert coming back for them to anchor that team, I just there's they've been so close, and ultimately this Queens team is never going to win the Yates Cup without overcoming the purple hurdle in Western. They're always going to be in their way, even if Western wasn't in the playoffs. I feel until you are able to beat that Western Pony team, you're not going to get back to that Yates Cup. And that's a huge ask, especially right now with how good this Western team is. But we saw a Queens team finish 5-3 this past year and go through an absurd amount of difficulties with losing guys, with injuries here and there, and all of this. And they still came out looking pretty good. So, somehow, even though they were back-to-back runners up in the Yates Cup, they certainly fell off this past year. I wouldn't sleep on the Golden Gales in Kingston. I still think that they've got some potential there.
And I was just going to throw in quickly, Nate, to your point about Windsor's sort of secret sauce was just you raised the point when we saw a couple Americans from the South come into whether it was Guelph, whether it was Windsor. And I'm trying to remember, I think there was a third American Q out there. And just like it seems like from what I recall you saying, and it makes all the sense to me as well, they're not playing the position that out of like, yeah, the yard difference can make a difference in how you get off the ball on the offensive line, but on the whole, like offensive line play is going to be pretty similar when you're wide out running the same kind of concepts and schemes. The width of the field is going to be different, so maybe that changes up. But ultimately, the coordinator's drawing up what you're running, everything like that. But for the quarterback, it makes a world of difference. And so at first, I was going to say, until they can, if that's the plan, they either need to find that American who can be in the system long enough to properly learn the Canadian game and all the nuances that come with it, or is Nick Domofsky going to be the quarterback leading the next non-Western team to a Yates Cup? To be determined there. But speak on that piece as well, because I know we talked about that a bit with some of the American quarterbacks of just like why that's different from perhaps any other position you'd be playing coming across the border.
Yeah, it's funny. It's like it literally would benefit almost every other position on the field. You know, maybe argue against a D line, but like I'm sure a guy like Joey Zorn doesn't mind having all that extra space on the field. You know, but yeah, I think you know the coverage you're seeing is the same, I guess, in theory, but in practice, it's like you know the motion that's going on. I mean, you know, U.S. only one guy can move at a time. You know, no one's running up to the line of scrimmage. You know, it makes such a big difference, and I think you know it's such an adjustment, really. You think about having extra guys on the field and that kind of thing. So I remember going to the like w when we would do the travel teams in the States, it almost felt like everything got simpler. Whereas, you know, I can imagine going the other way. Head might be spinning a little bit. So, you know, I could, you know, even like it's such a stupid thing, but like your depth perception, like you have to see further guys that are further away. You have to, you know, it is different, and it doesn't surprise me, and I, you know. Aside from Rooker, you know, guys haven't had a lot of success coming up here. So,
Yeah, well, you even think about what like a super basic throw, like a 5 yard out, that is
a 40-yard
infinitely
throw.
longer in the Canadian game. So much more area for opportunity for a defense to recognize, come back down on it, versus the American game where it really is just a quick pitch and catch a lot of the time. Obviously, there is still some risk, but you're on the like the far side of the field throwing it. It's like a 40-yard pass, it feels at times.
Yeah, your anticipation has to be so much more dialed because you can't just overcome things by ripping the ball in there all the time. It's that's how you get into trouble, honestly.
Well, you know, if the game really does get that much easier when you cross the border heading south, man, oh man, could that Toronto West prep team have really used you when they went out to play IMG a couple years ago, Nate Hobbs. Nate, our friend, in the event you aren't calling up plays for prep schools, U of T, IMG Academy, or anywhere in between.
Hold on. Oh. I don't wanna ruin your monologue, Zach, but I have one more take I want to get on.
Go, shoot. Fire.
You're gonna hate me for it, but I see sort of a. I know I've made this comparison in the past between sort of a Michigan Ohio State connection in the OUA between Queens and Western recently, and I just think in the next couple of years you're gonna see a flip. And I think, you know, it's such a homer thing for me to say, and like. You know, I watch more U of T games than I watch Queens games, so don't be saying it's completely biased. It's a little biased, but I think you're going to see it flip over the next couple of years. And I think Queens might become the powerhouse that Western was, or at least, you know, the closest thing to it. I think you see the way the program is out there. I think you see the facilities. I think they have something to offer that is a level above what anyone else can offer to a young kid. I think you look at kids coming out and, I don't know what a better situation is. And it's better than when I went there with the facilities and everything. So that's my take, is I think you're gonna see Queens become the new Western of the OUA. And you know, you've already kind of seen a little bit in how they play and how they recruit the kind of guys they're getting. So it's my take. You know, it's a lot of pressure. I'll wear when you know, they get another heartbreaking loss, I'll wear it. You know, as long as if I haven't seen enough already. So you can't hurt what's already defeated. You know what I mean?
Nate, you might be repping the U of T Blues a bit more these days, but you're always an OKG in our books. Nate or Tom, let me give you last word and we'll wrap this thing up.
Oh, God, Nate, it's always a pleasure to have you on the pod here and just talk shop with somebody who is as passionate as Zach and I are about the OUA here. And I love your take that Queens is coming back and they're coming back with a force. I think we saw a little snippet of them the past couple of years. Obviously this past year they dealt with a lot, but I wouldn't be too surprised to see them start to gain some momentum and maybe steal one from the Ponies sometime soon. But until they do it, the Ponies are still on top here. So it's always a pleasure, my friend. All you need is one. That's right. Any given Sunday and all that, or any given Saturday afternoon at 1 o'clock where all the teams play. But it's always a pleasure to have you on, and a sincere thank you from myself to making it on the pod once again, my friend.
My pleasure, fellas. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it all, as always, Nate. That wraps up episode 3 of the Exit Meeting with Nate Hobbs talking about the U of T Blues. Next week, we're diving into the wild world of a couple teams in the Guelph Griffins and the Waterloo Warriors. So we'll hit you up with those episodes right here at the 55.